Brother, what is the number? Priad asked as his comrade came closer.
25 squads,
Strabo said, unable to disguise the excitement in his voice.
25?
Priad had not known the chapter field such numbers in his lifetime. Not in one place. In the great age of the Reef Wars, perhaps, but in modern times? Even at Idon, they'd raised only 6.
For what undertaking? Priad asked.
Full war with the Greenskins, Strabo smiled. War with the swine. A mass incursion, so they say. A plague. It is reckoned Sadon himself will lead the order. We are sent to Ganahedorak to pitch combat with them there.
We, brother? Are you so confident?
Manor's squad is due selection, said Strabo. We deserve a slice of this glory, and Manor's has not been in such fettle for years.
I send you luck, said Priad.
And Damocles? Strabo asked. Surely your brothers are itching for a taste of this. Cast your ballot. Let it be Manes and Damocles, shoulder to shoulder, like the old days.
Priad half smiled and nodded. He stared at the casting calyx for a long time. The great bell of the fortress was tolling. There was no chamber, no hall, no basement in the chapter house of Charybdis where it couldn't be heard. To Priad, walking the shadowed hallways of the western barracks, it sounded like a dull gong, but that was merely due to his distance from it and the thick bastion walls that stood in between him and it. The great bell was the size of a drop pod, and a team of 20 servants in the belfry were hauling on the geared pulleys to move the striker. The toll announced that the period was over, and that the chapter master had made his selection for the order of battle. In the anteroom of the barrack hall, Damocles was gearing. The brothers stood amid the trestle frames, anointing and casing themselves. Clepiades and the other petitioners were serving them, working as earnestly and devotedly as regular chapter house attendants. Hair was being oiled and braided up, hands, forearms, and torsos bound tight with straps of leather and linen. Plug points were being lubricated, feed lines fixed across skin with flesh staples, armor plates dutifully connected and locked into place. The petitioners were polishing every segment of armor with oil cloths, burnishing the surfaces to an almost mirror-quality gleam. Each segment was ritually blessed before it was clamped in place. Myrtle leaves and camphor burned in dishes around the alcoves, filling the air with perfume. All activity ceased as Priad came in. The brothers rose to their feet to face him, most of them half-suited in their armor. Priad saw his own case of armor supported ready on a trestle, polished to a spectacular finish, his power claw on a smaller trestle to the side.
25 squads, so we were told,
Chiron said at last, breaking the expectant hush.
Damocles is battle ready. What is the undertaking?
Xander asked, his golden eyes bright.
The chapter makes war on the Greenskins,
Priad replied. There was an eager mutter.
The master himself leads the battle chosen to combat. The master himself leads the battle chosen to combat.
A momentous day,
said Pindor, old enough to remember the last time such a grand muster had been made.
What are our orders, Brother Sergeant?
Andromach asked. He was holding the squad standard in his huge, gauntleted hands.
We are ready for you to begin the rites.
Priad did not blink.
Damocles has not been selected, he said.
The silence that followed had a heavy, painful quality.
Damocles has not been selected,
Xander repeated slowly, as if he could make no sense of the words.
We have not been selected for this undertaking, Priad said.
There's been an error made,
Andromach spluttered.
An error? Cried Natus. An insult, more like. Damocles is one of the notables. This spits on our honor.
The others began to add their voices to the complaint. Chiron remained silent, watching Priad with hooded eyes.
25 squads and we didn't rate, Xander raged. This is a joke. To think the chapter master would select even the 10 best squads, the 5 best, and Damocles not be one of them.
The chapter master did not select Damocles, said Priad, because I did not cast our token into the calyx.
Chiron sighed. Xander looked fit to strike at Priad, his face seething with uncomprehending fury. Cylon placed a firm hand on Xander's arm to stay him.
Why?
Asked Cools.
An officer casts his ballot to announce his squad is battle ready.
Priad stared at them all.
Damocles is not battle ready. Not at all.
The hell you say!
Xander exclaimed.
What's that mouth?
Chiron growled.
The brother sergeant's word is law in this room.
You feel cheated of glory?
Priad asked them.
Good. By your own admission, all of you have reveled in the empty glory of the trench. You have given in to your own weakness and pride. You are not fit to advance under the standard.
That's nonsense,
Andromach cried.
It may be forbidden, but the trench is an old, respected honor test. There will be dozens of battle brothers selected today who have done it.
But they have not openly confessed to their officers. Besides, each and every squad leader commands by the terms of his own conscience. I do not expect a high standard of behavior from Damocles. I expect a flawless standard of behavior. Strip off your armor and make ready for practice drills. Expect at least a month of primary regimen, and there will be stripes to take before the day's end.
Is this punishment?
Asked Akon.
No,
answered Priad.
It's atonement. When I think you've restored your honor, and mine, then I might approve you as battle-ready.
Chapter 5 The moon Charybdis seemed to fill half the night sky. It shone with a glassy, perfect clarity through the cold air. Priad perched on the top of an outcrop of dark blue ice, the bronze cleats of his ice boots chipping into the surface, and pulled his furs around him. He gazed up at the fortress moon, and fancied he could still see the light wakes of the departing battle barges, making way on their undertaking, bound for glory. Imagination, of course. By his estimation, the battle company had left at least 5 days earlier. He hadn't even allowed Damocles the consolation of attending the embarkation parade. He rose to his feet, his lungs full of biting winter air, and looked back down the white glow of the glacier with his night-adjusted eyes. This was Craratia, greatest and mightiest of the glaciers, that snaked their gigantic bulks out of Ithaca's southern pole into the frozen, ice-littered seas. There was no wind, but the temperature was 8 below, due to the emptiness of the sky. In the far west, above the Oikon ramparts, snow-bearded frost giants that form the central massif of the polar region, the twinkling stars were hazy, as through a fine mesh. An ice storm was brewing, filling its cheeks with the purest, lethal cold of the polar heartland. It could be on them in an hour, cutting like a swarm of blades. He jumped down from the outcrop onto the rink-flat surface of the glacier itself. Smooth, violet ice, dusted with a skin of powder snow that seemed almost luminous in the moonlight. His cleats kicked up flurries of it in the still air, and he steadied himself on his blade pole. He waited for Damocles to come into view. Priad was clad in an insulated body glove, boots, mailed ice gloves, and a hooded mantle of snow leopard furs. The brothers of Damocles enjoyed no such luxury. They came in sight, jogging hard across the flatness of the glacier shelf. Bare feet, aching from contact with the ice, bare legs and arms and hands, simple chitons of thin, red linen. They wore frost shawls, tied like sashes around their waists, supporting small pouches of simple utility items and bronze ice axes. They were panting, cheeks raw and pinched, sweat freezing on their upper arms and brows. Each man was lugging a 30-kilo block of ice on his shoulder. Priad watched them approach. He struck his blade pole into the ice and unhooked the sling scales from his waist belt, shaking out the canvas loops. The men came closer. As Priad expected, Xander was in the lead by some distance, Andromach and Diognes behind him, then Cools, with his odd, almost waddling manner of running. The rest of them played out behind. This was the 6th time in 3 days they had run this drill, and each time Xander had made the best showing. Xander ran up and came to a halt, his bare feet blue numb, scuffing in the snow. He slid the block off his shoulder, leaving the folds of the chiton there, clinging with meltwater.
"Brother Sergeant,"
he gasped, supporting the glistening block in his hands. Priad fitted the canvas loops around the block, supported the scales by the brass hook, and let the weight swing free. The gauge read 31.5 kilos.
"Pass,"
said Priad, letting the block fall out and smash on the ground.
"Go dig your burrow."
Xander nodded, too cold to speak, and limped away, pulling out his ice axe. He headed for the snowbanks on the far side of the glacier. Diognes arrived next, outrunning Andromach for the first time. Andromach was close behind and had to wait as Diognes' block was weighed.
31.1 kilos, a pass, Priad said.
Diognes nodded, grateful, and respectfully waited while Andromach got his reading.
30.7 kilos. You pass too.
One by one, the men reached Priad. The drill was simple enough. Each man had to hack out a block of ice with his axe, then run with it down 20 kilometers of the glacier. Who came first and who last was not the question. The block simply had to weigh in excess of 30 kilos by the time it was measured at the finish. There was no weigh-in at the start. Each man had to gauge the weight of his block by eye and common sense, allowing for that part of it that would be lost to melt during the course of the drill. Underestimate, and the block would be less than the crucial 30 kilos by the time it was delivered. Indeed, on the first day, Akon's inexperience led him to cut a slab that couldn't have been more than 27 kilos to begin with. But overestimation was a handicap too. Cut too much of a margin of error, and the runner would be laboring under far more weight than he needed to manage. On his second run, Akon compensated for his initial error and brought back a block that was over 38 kilos. He had barely been able to stand by the time he arrived. Failure to meet the 30-kilo cutoff required a candidate to repeat the drill, alone, if necessary, as many times as it took for him to get a pass. Pindor and Chiron, the oldest men, were the last to finish. Pindor's slab weighed in at a fraction over 30, the lightest load, but legal. Priad passed him, and he went to join the others, digging resting holes in the snowbank with their axes. Chiron's block weighed 29.9 kilos. The apothecary tossed it aside so that it splintered on the ground and turned away, taking a deep breath. Though he was as aggrieved with Chiron as with the rest of them, Priad had felt it unseemly for the apothecary to participate in the common drills. But Chiron had rejected any notion of favored treatment. He had demanded to be tested on a par with the others. As a result, he had rerun the drill twice in the past 2 days.
"Pass," said Priad.
"It was not,"
Chiron replied, without turning round.
"I say it was. Get to your burrow."
"I was unsuccessful. I am required to repeat the test."
"Brother, there's a storm coming in."
"Let it bite."
"Damn it," Priad said. "Do as I tell you. Your blasted stoicism."
"It's not a matter of stoicism, Brother Sergeant. It's about dignity. Did my slab weigh 30 kilos?
"No."
"Then I'll see you again in 3 hours.
Chiron shook out his arms and began to run. Priad watched as a lone figure tracked away down the river of ice. Priad crunched across the glacier to the snowbank where the men were digging in. Most had untied their frost shawls and draped them around their shivering bodies as they curled up into the insulated dens they had scraped out of the drift. Priad had a habi tent, a single occupancy module with a thermal cell. He got inside without a word, took off his mailed gloves, and chafed his hands beside the glowing heater. Outside, a wind began to stir. He had been in a self-induced catalepsian state for an hour or so, sleeping, yet awake, allowing portions of his mind to close down and rest in sequence while his forebrain stayed alert. All the while, he had controlled and conditioned the flow and exchange of blood in his system, preserving and distributing heat. All of Damocles was doing the same, though it was easier for him in a secure habitat with a heater source. Priad snapped sharp at a sound outside that the rising moan of the wind couldn't disguise. He took up his blade pole and left the tent. There were snow bears in these latitudes, massive creatures that could shear a man in two. He scanned the area, sniffing the cold air for scat or odor. The men were dormant in their burrows. The moon was still huge, but it had fogged and blurred, as if a dust was in the sky. The wind was stronger, gusting slightly, winnowing snow down the slope and rippling the loose flakes out across the surface of the glacier like eddies of fine sugar. Something was here. Something close. Pole in hand, he climbed to the top of the slope, from where he could see the ice storm rising in the distance, still 200 kilometers away, a ghost shroud across the lower sky.
"Mine was a gold figurine of Parthus," said a voice behind him.
Priad wheeled, his pole raised. He lowered it slowly. Facing him was a huge Ithacan male wrapped in a cloak of snowbear skin. Petrok.
"What are you... Sir, what are you doing here?"
"Visiting. Observing training.
How goes it?"
"Well," Priad said, still off guard and confused,
"the men are fit. A few rough edges."
Petrok nodded.
"That's good. You'll knock the roughness off with a winter regimen like this. How long have you been drilling?"
8 days.
"And you'll keep at it?"
"For another 8. Then 20 days in the dune wash. Basic endurance."
Petrok smiled.
"They really must have pissed you off," he said.
"Regimen is necessary. So the Codex states. Even the best must work to preserve their edge."
8 days, Petrok mused. "So you missed the embarkation, then?"
"Yes."
"A splendid sight. The like we hadn't seen in decades. Sadon was so damn eager to taste war again. Like a boy warrior, sharpening his own blades, oiling his own hair. He had to blow the cobwebs off his armor."
Priad snorted, but felt ashamed at the disrespect.
"Don't worry, brother," Petrok said.
"Sadon made the joke himself.
Come help me with these cobwebs, Petrok," he said. "I'm sure there's armor in here somewhere. War, my brother. It was good to see his appetite back, advancing out at the head of his notables."
Petrok looked up at the occluded stars.
"Not all his notables, of course."
"It is only right the master is served by the best and the ready," said Priad.
"He was disappointed, you realize," replied Petrok, "when he found you hadn't voted. He asked for it to be checked. Thebes, they, Parthus, and Scipio in his front rank, and no Damocles. What would Raphon have made of that?"
"He would have made the same decision, I believe," said Priad.
"Of course, brother. Or he wouldn't have named you his heir."
"I still don't understand why you're here, sir."
"Petrok, remember? I thought we'd cleared this up. Idon, wasn't it? You call me Petrok unless I tell you otherwise."
"I understood you'd been left in command, in the master's absence."
"I have. Locum master of the chapter house, Charybdis. You know how dull that is. No wonder Sadon was itching for war. It takes me away from my other work. Mandates to approve, parades and exercises to observe, petition selections, all manner of inventory to consider. The equerries by the throne. They drive a man mad with their fussing and their lists. I can't bear them. I've killed 4 or 5 of them already."
Priad said nothing.
"It's all right. I've hidden the bodies well."
Priad blinked.
"Funny, you can spot a tracer round flying at your head in time to duck it. But a joke?"
"That was a joke."
"I haven't killed any equerries. It's frowned upon."
Priad smiled.
"There, you see. And they say the Astartes has no place for humor."
"Why are you here?"
"Ah, we're getting philosophical now, are we?"
"Sir, Petrok, please."
Petrok shrugged his heavy shoulders under the furs.
"I was bored.
I fancied a taste of unprocessed air. Rhodos told me that Damocles had gone down to Ithaca for some winter training, so I thought I'd run an inspection. There's nothing sinister or devious about it. Besides, this is good bear country. I fancied I might claim myself a new pelt.
He pulled something out from under his furs. Priad expected a bolter, or at least the mighty blade Belus. Instead, he saw Petrok was holding a stabbing knife with a saw-tooth edge. It glittered in the darkness.
"You think we'll find one?"
Petrok asked, cheerfully.
"I hope not."
"Ah, well."
Petrok looked west and sniffed the air.
"Storm's rising. A bitter one."
"Where's your tenth man?"
"How did you—"
"One tent and eight burrows. One less than I have fingers. Who is it?"
"Chiron. He's repeating the block drill."
"Poor bastard,"
Petrok said.
"Overdue?"
"Not yet."
"Let's take a walk and see how he's doing. If the storm catches him, he'll be dead. You don't want the bother of finding a new apothecary, do you? I mean, after the trouble you went to getting this one."
Petrok slithered away down the snowbank, pole blade in hand. Priad followed him. Chapter 6. They trudged along the flatness of the glacier, side by side in the filmy moonlight.
"What did you mean? A gold figure of Parthus?"
Priad asked after a while.
"My offering," Petrok replied.
"Offering?"
"To the trench. I was young, foolish. I believe only the second of those two things is a requirement, but the first helps."
"You dived the trench?"
"During my first year, with Parthus' squad. On exercise. It was all the fashion back then, more than it is today. Positively encouraged by the upper ranks, but discreetly, of course. You weren't off the fratry unless you'd taken a worm and done the trench. A test of personal skill and fortitude. Customs change, I suppose. The frequent deaths didn't help."
"So you're a trencher?"
Petrok shook his head.
"Not me. I dived down, the figure of Parthus in my fist. I chose Parthus because he was my squad founder. I never made it. Missed my count. Ran out of breath. Barely got back to the surface alive. I was sick with the narcosis fever for days. My brothers covered up for me. It's a hard dive. But you know that. You're a trencher, too."
"No, I'm not," said Priad.
"You went into the trench."
"And I didn't bring any glory back. Just a dead boy."
"I've heard about it. I read the Lexicania report. And I spoke to Chiron. He told me what had been left out of the report."
"He never said anything to me."
"He wouldn't. He's a proud man. Diligent. He told me how every last man in Damocles had owned up to diving the trench at some time or other. He told me how horrified you'd been to hear it. I guess that's why you didn't vote, and why you're driving them so hard now. Penitence.
Atonement. We have rules for a reason. Gilliman didn't compose the codex for his own entertainment. I am ranking squad officer. It's my duty to punish and admonish."
Petrok was silent for a while.
"Priad, have you not thought why they told you? Why they all confessed to you, there, on the beach?"
Priad didn't answer.
"They didn't want you to dive and risk your life. They didn't want to lose you. For all the dishonor they knew their confession would bring upon them, they wanted you to know that every one of them was ready, willing, and able to take your place. You know what I think that is? They openly admitted to breaking the chapter rules. I think it's called loyalty. But I make
bad jokes about murdering staff, so what do I know?
The wind was picking up again, abrading their cheeks with its touch, and leaving a dust of ice crystals in their hair and the furs they wore.
This is why you've come, isn't it? Priad said. To counsel me and show me my error.
You made no error, brother. Work them as hard as you like. Break their backs. Whatever glory they get to take in their lives, it's yours to determine. If you'd let them off, you'd have weakened your command. What you're doing here is right. I just wanted to make sure you appreciated the whole picture.
They strode on.
By the way, that's not why I've come here.
Petrov stopped short. He pointed. Far away, a kilometer or more, they could make out a tiny figure struggling towards them along the glacier. It wasn't running so much as stumbling.
Chiron, said Priad.
On his way back. Throne, look at the size of the block he's humping. You won't need your scales.
Priad didn't reply. He was looking up at the snowbank to their left. 300 meters distant, something had moved, white on white. Priad touched Petrok's arm and pointed. They stood for a minute, still as Kuros statues in the fortress atrium, until it moved again.
Oh, that's a big one,
Petrok whispered.
A big female, I'd bet. She doesn't make us. We're upwind of her. But she's hunting.
She's hunting my apothecary, Priad whispered back. They like stragglers. When they chase a herd of longhorn, they target the weak and the slow. She's upwind of Chiron as much as we're upwind of her.
You've hunted Snow Bear before?
Petrok asked.
No. Raphon used to, for sport. He had a necklace of claws. He told me of the ways.
She's leading Chiron, all right. Staying ahead. Choosing her moment. Terra, look at her move.
Ah, lost her again. Behind that ridge.
What do we do?
Petrok smiled and drew his knife. They moved up into the snowbanks, low and quiet. Priad turned his pole around so that the meter-long, single-edged blade was slung forward like a sea lance. Petrok stopped and stripped off his boots, motioning Priad to do the same. The cleats were crunching in the brittle, crisp snow, but bare feet would make no sound. They both scrubbed their hands, faces, and armpits with handfuls of fresh snow to mask their pheromones. The wind stilled again, sudden and ominous, letting go of the particles it was carrying. Ice shards settled like smoke around them. They climbed the ridge, keeping the moon at an angle to minimize their shadows. Priad caught traces of animal warmth and breath stink on the air. Petrok signaled Priad to go left and disappeared from view along the right-hand edge of the drifts. The air was so clear. The stars seemed to tremble with the distant booming of the storm. Priad came to a halt, his feet ankle-deep in the snow. The moon glow lit the whiteness all around. He was close now, surely. It couldn't have moved away so fast. A snowdrift rose up and assaulted him. Ice-white, the skulking bear had been invisible until it moved. It let out a huge, shuddering roar as it came up. Priad glimpsed the yawning red cavity of its mouth, the massive yellow teeth. He smelled rank breath, polluted by saliva and seal blubber, and saw two diamond-black eyes. He tried to raise his pole, but it flew out of his hands as the gigantic forepaw struck him. Claws the size of fingers ripped through his mantle and cut deep gashes in the flesh of his left tricep. The impact was stunning. He felt like he'd been run down by a land raider. The Arctic world turned over and over, dazing thump after dazing thump. He realized he had rolled clean down the slope onto the face of the glacier, limbs flailing. Winded, bruised, he tried to rise. He saw spatters of his own blood glistening like rubies on the face of the ice. He looked up. The she-bear was coming for him. She was gigantic, 2,000 kilos of rippling muscle and fat, coated in white fur, forepaws the size of power claws, a muzzled skull as massive as a 30-kilo ice block, a gaping mouth as broad as the dish of the Strategoi's Ballot Kylix. Priad rolled. The colossal predator crunched down on the glacier top, cracking the surface sheet beneath it. She began to turn, bellowing again. Petrock landed on her, straddling her hunched back. The knife flashed, and the bear whined in pain. She thrashed around, throwing Petrock off. The locum master cartwheeled across the ice, bouncing hard. The bear was lunging at him before he'd even slithered to a halt. Priad's pole was gone. He groped for a weapon, any weapon, and found the sling scales. He ran forward, feet slipping, lifting the scales like a huntsman's noose. The bear was mauling Petrock, pressing him into the ice as she tore at his furs. Priad got in behind her and threw out the canvas loops of the scales. He got one of them down around the bear's throat and began to drag back with every shred of his upper body strength, drawing the loop tight into a choking collar, yanking the bear's head backwards. She writhed up, clawing at the constriction, and almost crushed Priad by sitting on him. He dragged tighter, scrambling away and tugging at the scale's hook. The bear began to make a deep, gurgling rasp as her windpipe closed. Priad maintained his grip, pulling even tighter, his powerful arms quivering with the effort. The bear shook again, trying to find him with her paws. He jerked the loop tighter, ever tighter. The bear tried to rise onto all fours. Petrock appeared in front of her, his face and chest smeared with blood. As the bear reared again, Petrock rammed his knife up between her front limbs. It stuck fast in the bone. Blood steamed like boiling water as it poured out onto the ice. The bear flicked a paw and swatted Petrock aside. She fell forward, Priad still cinched around her throat, dragging him off his feet. He pulled again, trying to wind the loops now to constrict them further, frantically holding on. She wouldn't die. She simply wouldn't die. Nose down on the glacier, crawling forward, her inhalation stuttering and clamped, she fought on with impossible vigor. She dragged him 20 meters, like a rider clinging to the reins of a bolting mount, and left a dark stream of blood behind her. There was a brutal, crushing impact. Priad heard bone break, and the bear went still. Slowly, he relaxed his grip and slid off the sprawled monster. She was dead, or at least in the final fluttering seconds of life. Inert. Broken. Her skull had been half crushed by a 30-kilo block of ice that had been driven into her head from above with inhuman force. Bent down, hands braced against his thighs, Chiron stood nearby, panting hard and trying not to be sick from the effort.
"Sit down," Priad said.
Chiron nodded and curled up in a heap to recover his breath and his wits. With a last whimper of escaping gas and fluid, the animal expired, a hoarse, phlegmy rattle issuing from its ruptured throat. Priad limped across the ice to where Petrock lay in a puddle of blood. The great warrior looked as dead as the bear, but he roused as Priad bent over him.
"Where are you cut?" Priad asked.
"All over,"
Petrock replied, lisping through a sliced lip. Still, he managed to grin.
"But it's worse than it looks. Fine sport, eh, my brother?"
Priad shook his head and laughed. He gazed back at the bear's corpse, fascinated by the sheer size of the jaws and teeth, now exposed by the rictus of death that pulled the pink lips back in a snarl.
"The bite on that thing," he muttered. "So damn big."
"A massive set of jaws," said Petrock,
rising slowly to a sitting position and holding a deep laceration on his chest together. Priad realized he wasn't talking about the bear.
"There was a reason I came here tonight," he said slowly, his respiration ragged, "beyond the reasons I gave you before. I had a dream. I get them from time to time. It's part of my nature, and I've known enough of them not to ignore them."
"A dream?"
"When a chapter librarian dreams, brother, you pay heed, especially when they dream of you."
"You dreamt about me?"
Priad said, gingerly testing the gashes on his arm to check they were already healing.
"Yes, Priad, I dreamt about you. I don't know what it means yet. I was hoping you might help. I dreamt a scene, a place, a woodland. You were there. Others, too. But I haven't remembered that part properly yet.
Damocles?
I don't think it was. But you were there. And there was a massive set of jaws, as big as the bear's. But the teeth weren't sharp. They were blunt. Does that mean anything?
Priad shook his head.
Think on it. It's important.
Priad nodded. He looked back over his shoulder to find Chiron. The apothecary was walking away from them.
Where do you think you're going, old man?
Priad called.
To repeat the drill,
Chiron replied.
I lost my slab.
It was 30 kilos. You pass, you old fool.
I lost my slab,
Chiron repeated. Priad helped Petrok to his feet. The wind was picking up again, raising powder snow in swirling loops from the facing bank. The storm was inbound now, closing fast.
Chiron,
Petrok called out above the rush of the wind. The apothecary turned.
Drill's done,
Petrok said.
Chapter 7 Ganahedorak had suffered miserably at the hands of its invaders. They had come, not swift and vicious in the night, as was the way of the malign primals, but bold and loud and slow. Their ships, if such cumbersome machine monstrosities deserve the name ships, had arrived like lost moons, slowly tacking in through the outer magnetic fields and taking up low orbits like wayward, lumpen meteors, visible to the naked eye. They made no effort to conceal themselves, or even to effect a fast deployment. Surface batteries around some of the northern cities began firing on the menacing objects, but though hits were recorded, no damage seemed to result. The greenskins didn't much seem to care if a few fresh pits and craters were scored into the hulls of their lumbering craft. It had been a long time since the greenskins had let slip their particular brand of horror on the worlds of the reef stars. For 30 centuries, their kind had not been seen, and the memory of them had dulled. Ganahedorak had its memory refreshed on the 16th day after the new moons arrived in its skies. The greenskins began to descend to the planet's surface, their transports dropping like heavy comets. They did not fall upon the cities, but deposited themselves on the wide northern plains, forming up great hordes upon the flats there, hiding their numbers in the dust they kicked up. Then, raucous and loud, their braying and roaring audible from 50 kilometers away, they began to move. 1/5 of Ganahedorak's 80 cities burned on the first night. 3 principal battles took place. The first, at Arpel's Plain, lasted a day. 30,000 men, led by the glittering armored warriors of the King's Legion, marched out to meet one of the dust clouds. None returned. 3 days later, 8,000 men massed on the lowlands outside Kubrisa City, a fortress town in the Lower Cates. Supported by regiments of pike and musket and retinues of the militia, the vanguard of the human army was composed of the Cates dragoons, riding their great crested lizards, and the immortals of the Queen's Summoners. Their pinions were gold and blue and green. Their swords shone like mirrors in the sun. The enemy arrived, a droning wall of dust and noise, clashing their weapons against their shields, roaring into the sky. They advanced as slowly as a lava tide. A smell came off them, putrid and rank, like vegetation rotting in the bottom of a sump. As they came into view, they didn't seem very green at all. Body paint, black and red and white, caked the massive, shambling figures, and they were shrouded in animal skins and cloaks of chainmail. The summoners broke in fear, and were cut down as they attempted to flee across the brook at Lytton. Such butchery was done, and witnessed by the remaining ranks, that fear spread. The smell of blood was in the air, like heated copper. The dragoons engaged then, driving their lizards into the lines of the foe. Lance tips and lizard beaks became wet and glistening with ichor. Trumpets sounded. For a brief moment, victory seemed to taste stronger than inhuman blood. Then the greenskins, or the painted ones as they had become known by that time,
rallied. In fact, they didn't even seem to rally as such. The line of them, 30 deep, towering monsters twice as tall as a man and thrice as broad, just seemed to flex, like a muscular arm, and throw back the dragoon files. By the time the city fell, witnesses reported seeing lizard mounts, some weighing half a ton, carried forward as trophies, skewered on the pikes of the foe. Routed, the human soldiers fell back to Chesley, where they were reinforced by 20 companies of rifle and some 200 cannon sent up, in haste, from the trading towns around the Gulf of Loomis. There, in the shallow valley of the Kibus River, the third battle took place. The cannon teams barraged the painted ones for 3 hours after daybreak. Then the rifleman infantry pressed forward into an enemy line punctured by the force of the artillery. For 2 hours, a running fight played out amongst the valley woods. By sunset, there was no human left alive in the valley, or at least none that would still be alive come the following daybreak. The woodlands burned. The painted ones, so it was said, feasted through the night on human flesh, torn from corpses that had been cooked simply by hanging them from the boughs of the burning trees. 2 days after that, Chapter Master Sadon led his snakes down onto the surface. By then, the northern hemisphere was lost to humanity, reduced to a trampled, ashen waste of scorched bones and fire-stripped cities. The kings of the south had prepared the way for the Iron Snakes. They were fearful men, their armies traditionally weaker than those of the north, those that had already been vanquished. The kings of the south were relieved to see the bold warriors of Ithaca arrive. In the grassy, wind-blown uplands, great roundhouse halls had been erected to shelter the Iron Snakes. Stone-built, with roofs of peat, they had been built out of respect and gratitude, the kings of the south expecting the snakes to require bastions in which to sleep and feast prior to the war. It had taken Sadon some time to persuade the kings that his warriors needed no such comforts. In their cases of armor, polished to a steel-glass finish, the Iron Snakes seemed like gods to the local men. Their voices and manners were strange, their weapons and war gear frightening. They smelled curiously of oils and unguents, and each one of them was twice the size of a regular human. They assembled to begin their war-making. The greenskins approached, a vast rowdy horde that covered the land. Sighting the Ithacan fratry, the enemy began to chant and mock, goading a response. Sadon gave none immediately. The greenskins were numerically superior, 5-1. Sadon formed his snakes into a battle line around the ramparts of the uplands and waited. He had reduced planets into cinders in his time. He would choose his moment. Such was the luxury of an assured commander in formal war. After 3 days of bellowed mockery, the greenskins began an assault. Most of their charging front echelon died, pulped and split like overripe pumpkins under the steady bolter fire. Bruised and thwarted for the first time since making planetfall, the greenskins set up a keening lament long into the night. The next day, they tried again. Captain Phobor, hero of Ithaca, led the line to deny. In the space of 15 minutes, the squads under his command, including two of the notables, Parthus and Thebes, took the lives of 800 orcs. The low-lying heather was rendered flat and wet with ichor for many acres. Huge, misshapen corpses littered the slopes. The greenskins renewed their attack. Vey met the brunt of it. Around a stand of tall trees known as Hespen's Copse beforehand, and the Glory Hill ever after. Orc bodies were piled 5 deep in the heather, and virtually all the trees in the stand were shorn off at hip height by gunfire. 5 Space Marines perished, including Lexicanium Nokis and veteran hero Rubicus, champion of Syracuse. The latter was found, decapitated, at the top of an earthwork bank after the battered enemy lines had retreated. The cadavers of 60 orcs littered the bank beneath him, tumbled and torn in the undergrowth. Phobor took the news hard. Rubicus, he said, deserved a better end than this. He advocated a revenge assault into the command lines of the enemy. Sadon refused, until he saw how deeply Phobor grieved, and how lackluster the men of Veii had become without their most famous champion. He approved the assault. It fell to lots, as was the practice at such times, and Partha's squad won the honor of avenging the loss of their noble brothers in Veii. Brother Sergeant Zeron of Parthas led the attack. Moving more rapidly and directly than the Greenskins expected, he sliced into their command group at the summit of a low hill west of the copse and made great slaughter. Zeron personally took the head of a Swinekin chieftain and raised up the grisly mass on his lance. Over 400 Greenskins died in the attack. But that didn't seem to matter. Across the plain, the numbers of the enemy seemed without end. As the wind changed, Sadon saw in dismay that a second horde had appeared from the west, unannounced. More extraordinarily, this new force went to war with the existing mass of greenskins. Orc fought orc, two screaming, rampaging tides that clashed and locked into one another. This onslaught lacked all sense or reason. Sadon was forced to pull his forces back before they were overwhelmed between the twin opposing tides of shrieking monsters. Partha's squad, extended and alone, was cut off. On the low hill, they were caught up in the internecine bloodshed as the greenskins murdered one another. Locked as on an island, they fought to the last, slaying huge numbers in the thundering chaos. One by one, they fell, consumed in the sheer tumult, fighting off greenskins from every side. They were ground to atoms between the clashing fronts of the rival orc armies. He saw it all. He saw Zeron, last to fall. Zeron, his old squad commander, his trainer, his mentor, staggering from multiple wounds, slashing and stabbing with a broken sword, his bolter spent, his polished armor wet and gleaming with ichor. He felt the blow land. An axe, sharp-toothed, cleaving through the back of Zeron's helmet. He saw the lenses of Zeron's helm fill up with blood, saw the trampled heather rush up to meet his face through the wine-dark fluid. He felt the chopping blows rain down on his unguarded back, breaking plate, breaking shoulder blades, breaking spine. His legs went numb, without feeling. He saw the world through blood, and saw only blood. And woke up. Petrok was chilled with sweat. His limbs quivered. He had to touch his own face, bare and helmet free, to believe there was no blood upon it. The chapter house was silent. Rhodos, he called, hoarse. Rousing, the lexicanium came to him.
Find Priad, Petrok told him. Tell him to make Damocles ready. Ready or not. The chapter master needs us.
Select from the others, Priad said simply.
I have, and I will, said Petrok. But I want Damocles. I want at least one squad of notables in my phalanx, and Sadon has all the rest.
With respect, Priad began.
Then show me some, Petrok snapped, rising to his feet.
His private chamber was dark and cold, lit only by a few tapers and sour with the reek of burned herbs. He had been making offerings to the spirits of war and guidance. Bronze bowls full of pungent ash sat along the ledges of his wall shrine.
I apologize, Petrok said quietly. My friend, I was too sharp just then. My mind is troubled.
I can tell, said Priad.
Sadon is in danger. The undertaking is in danger.
Priad tensed.
I have heard nothing.
No word has yet come, Priad. But a dream I have had. A bloody dream. There was warning in it, faster and surer than any dispatch. I aim to raise a force of at least 5 squads and journey to his aid. But Damocles is... If you say Damocles is not battle-ready, Priad, I swear I'll strike you down. I don't care. I admire your strength of command and your duty. Perhaps your men do need stern punishment. That's your rule to lay down. But these new concerns outweigh them. I require Damocles to form the heart of my force, whether you deem them ready or not.
I see, said Priad.
If you command, sir.
Back to sir again, are we? Fair enough. I spoke harshly. But I'm not Phobor. I won't command you and then give you no good reasons. I want Damocles along for two very good ones.
Which are?
I trust you. I believe Damocles is just about the best combat squad the chapter has to offer. Your presence will help keep some of the less experienced units in line. Secondly, and far more important, I dreamed about you, Priad. Remember?
I do.
What do you know of fate? Petrok asked, fixing himself a cup of wine. He offered the jug to Priad, who shook his head.
Fate, sir? It's the will of the Emperor. It's the marrow of our lives.
Spoken like a true petitioner, Petrok smiled. Consider this, my friend. You prevented Damocles from accompanying the chapter master, though they would most surely have been chosen if you'd put them forward. Because they disgraced themselves in your eyes? Perhaps. But perhaps, instead, it was fate's purpose. Perhaps Damocles had to disgrace itself so they would still be here at Charybdis for me to call upon now.
Your mind works in wonderful ways, Master, Priad smiled. Truly. I see no such sense myself. My men broke fratry rules, and I have confined them for it until they know better. I see no great scheme of fate, just warriors who must toil until they understand discipline.
Petrok nodded. For argument's sake, let's pretend I'm right. In the name of the Golden Throne, Priad, I've never met any soul as pragmatic as you. I believe that's why Rhaephon chose you as his successor.
Do you question Rhaephon's choice? Priad asked.
Not at all. Rhaephon and Memnes, Emperor love them, were quite right about you. Now, summon your squad for me.
I will, sir, if that's an order.
Consider it so. Fate is expecting us.
Chapter 8. There was a meadow, sunlit, a bright blue sky, summer heat in the air, something moving in the corn. A meadow, golden in the sun, blue sky, there in the stirring corn, something black. Meadow, sky, something. Meadow again, the sky as blue as the waters of a certain bay on the Cydides Isthmus. The moving something brushed through the yellow corn. A meadow, a something. A black dog, trotting through the corn, jumping in sport at passing cornflies. His heart began to beat. Priad woke. The iron vault was so cold, wet frost had coated the walls. The lumen strips had been turned down to their lowest setting, and the vault was full of green shadows. A deep, slow rumble came from behind the bulkheads. Stiff and slow, Priad got up from his brass cot. His mind felt as numb and pinched as his body. He flexed his bare hands in front of his face, saw the vapor of his breath break around them. Sense was slowly returning. He'd been dreaming. Something about a meadow, over and over again. He took a look back down the rows of brass cots filling the vault, and then padded, barefoot, to the chamber door, pushed it open, and went through. Sensing his movement, lights in the adjacent compartment flickered on. It was warmer here, a dull, dry, artificial heat. He took one of the chitons, hanging from a line of pegs, and pulled it on, then walked across the rush matting to the shrine. The shrine was a simple alcove in the metal wall. The motifs of the fratry were inscribed around the arched recess. Within, taper pots and offering dishes sat on the ledge, along with other charms. Figurines, shells, fish scales. In the center of the ledge sat six copper flasks, banded with zinc. Priad knelt down before the shrine, lit two of the tapers, and then bowed his head, his hands planted against the rim of the ledge. He murmured his devotions, his thanks, and his blessings, his requests for good fortune in war, guidance, and success.
Brother,
Priad looked up. Chiron stood nearby, holding a bowl of steaming broth.
When did you wake?
Priad asked, rising to his feet and accepting the Prophet bowl with a nod of thanks.
2 hours ago.
Priad sipped. The broth, invigoratingly warm, was a revitalizing fluid, concocted from herbs and plant extracts to ease the distemper of animation. Apothecaries were always woken first to prepare such draughts for their silent comrades.
How far out are we? Priad asked.
A day, perhaps a day and a half. I sensed you were close to animation, so I prepared the draught. The others will wake in an hour or so. There's food, too, if you desire it.
Priad shook his head. He was still muzzy.
Anything to report?
Priad asked, sipping again.
I did not ask, and have not been told,
Charon replied.
Simple matters require attention first. But I can tell you Petrok is awake, and the armorers too. The embarkation hall sounds like a smithy.
Petrok's awake?
In truth, I don't believe he slept this voyage.
It wouldn't surprise me, said Priad.
How long? 19 days.
A good time.
The barge captain saw the look in Petrok's eyes when we boarded, smiled Chiron.
Petrok had ordered the squads to deanimate for the duration of the voyage. It wasn't standard practice, except for long hauls, but he told them he wanted them sharp for the moment they arrived. Priad knew the real reason was more complex. Of the 5 squads selected by Petrok, 2, Laemon and Redates, were composed of recent inductees, and most of them without any real battle experience. It was a technique Petrok favored, mixing veteran warriors, in this case the men of Nophon, Pelias, and the notable Damocles, in the line with newcomers. The inductees would receive invaluable experience as a result, and the veterans would overcome any complacency by compensating for the fact that some of the men around them were relatively inexperienced. It was an alloy that often brought out the best in a fighting company. But Petrok had ordered them to deanimate to keep the newcomers fresh. A voyage of undertaking, especially one such as this, where combat was inevitable, could fatigue the spirits of the inductees and encourage them to overtrain and overstretch themselves as they battled the twin menaces of tedium and anticipation. Better they should sleep and awake on the eve of war than spend 19 days pacing and fretting and impatient. Such worn-out souls were no use in war.
Is your heart clear?
Chiron asked.
My head isn't, replied Priad. I dreamed.
You dreamed? Of what?
I'm not sure. The same thing, over and again, like a picked transmission on loop play. I don't usually dream. In fact, I can't remember the last time I did.
And you can't remember the content?
Priad shrugged.
A dog in a meadow.
A dog in a meadow? What color was the dog?
Does it matter?
I hardly think so. I have always held that there are dreams and dreams. Some are like the ones our master Petrok has, true dreams, carried to him by the spirits of beyond, full of potent meaning and profound significance. They are the dreams that count. The rest of us, with our poor, blunt minds, if we dream at all, we dream of nothing and no one that matters. What color was the dog?
It was black.
A black hound? Brother, that's an ill omen.
Priad looked at his apothecary and realized the older man was joking. He grinned back.
No, I'm happy to see that,
Chiron said.
Too much glowering from you of late.
Priad raised his eyebrows, and Chiron tutted.
Don't start,
Chiron told him.
When I asked if your heart was clear, I meant clear of disdain. Damocles wronged you, Priad, and you are right to whip us up and down that glacier. And maybe we're still not clean enough in honor. But we're sailing to war now, for better or worse. In the fire of combat, Damocles will need you clear-hearted and strong in leadership. No grudges, no ill will.
I hold no grudges, Priad said.
Chiron shrugged.
Yet if you do, set them aside. Take them up again when we return to the fortress, for all I care. But leave them here for now.
Your counsel is appreciated, but unnecessary. I am clear of purpose. Black dog or no black dog.
Chiron nodded. There was a sound of bare feet on decking, and two more figures emerged from the deanimation vault, naked and stretching.